What's up, guys? This is Dan Giffen. Just wanted to say thanks for listening to the podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by Arturia. If you aren't familiar with Arturia's plugins or products, definitely check it out. I fully endorse these guys. They make some of the most incredible software for any kind of synths or keys, sounds that you could ever want. But today I want to talk to you about one of their newer plugins. It's called Pigments. It's a modern state-of-the-art virtual instrument. It lets you create some really awesome, exciting, deeply customizable sounds. It has a really nice interface. I've played with it and it just sounds fantastic. It's a twin audio engine. So if you don't know what that means, it just allows you to mix virtual and analog and wavetable oscillators to create the perfect starting point for your patches, for your sounds that you can build from the ground up. You can morph wavetables or import your own samples and wavetables. It's really cool. Pigments, it really combines their passion for vintage FM synthesis and analog sound with a modern wavetable synthesis to create the ultimate software synth. There's plenty of presets to get you going. Check out the unique sounds. You can go get Pigments and do a free trial and check it out at arturia.com, A-R-T-U-R-I-A.com. Check it out. There's a link in the show notes if you want to go check out this new plugin called Pigments. It's really cool. And that's enough for that. I'm excited for today's podcast with Peter Dyer. Speaking of synths, he is a wizard of all sorts. He's got a lot of really great things to share with us today. And here's today's podcast. Hope you enjoy. Thanks for listening, guys. Yeah, welcome everybody to another episode of the Ableton Music Producer Podcast. I'm Dan Giffen. Today, I'm super stoked. We've got a really great guest with us today. His name is Peter Dyer. He and I met, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 months ago at Laura Escudé's Masterclass in LA, which is a really good time. Yeah. And I got to sit in the hot seat and he drilled me with a lot of Ableton Live questions. It was wonderful. I think I might have passed, maybe. But yeah, no, a little history. Fire. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, but real quick history. So Peter, he's a LA-based keyboardist, producer, sound designer, Ableton Live user, obviously. His credits are pretty long. It includes working with Mariah Carey, Adam Lambert, St. Vincent. He's in the house band for American Idol on ABC, which you probably have heard of. He co-wrote Avicii's Wake Me Up, Shame on Me, and Flo Rida's Wobble and Can't Believe It. He's a producer, musical director for several TV shows. He did tour sound design for Katy Perry, Tegan and Sara, Rita Ora, Miguel. We could just go on. But yeah, man, I'm glad to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, problem.
Yeah, it's a good time. You're in LA still, right?
Yes, sir.
I like your studio. I can see in the background.
Thanks, man.
Got a lot of fun toys.
Oh yeah, too many toys. We're trying to get rid of some actually. So.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Well, if you're having like a garage sale.
Yeah, it'll be the most expensive rummage sale in Long Beach.
Yeah, let me know. I might come down and maybe get some more toys. Not that I need more, but it's just.
Yeah.
Is that a Voyager? A Moog Voyager?
There's a Voyager. There's Sub 37. There's a Moog one over here. You've got most of the Moog line and Dave Smith lines covered.
Yes. I'm all about it. Yeah, I've got a Sub 37 just hanging out next to me right now. That's I actually saw, well, you do a lot of videos and promo videos for a lot of these synthesizer companies. Like I saw you did one for Moog and...
Moog, Novation, Dave Smith / Sequential. Yeah,
a lot of good brands.
That's fun. Cool. It's the videos are usually a byproduct of having like worked on the synths as like a beta tester and a patch designer.
So. Cool. So yeah. So you designed a lot of the patches and the presets then for
I mean, there's a pool of, you know, folks that do it for everything, but I've had the privilege of doing that on the last several projects with Dave Smith and Moog. And so, you know, you get a prototype or an early beta or something that's got bugs and problems, stuff, and, you know, you get to put our 2 cents in, and some of it makes it, some of it doesn't. And then do preset design that hopefully people will use and get inspired by.
Yeah. No, that's cool, man. I want to hear more about that. But like first, usually I ask our guests, like, just talk about your musical background. Like, how did you get started with music? And like, where did that lead you to where you're at today?
I mean, I did the typical like piano lessons as a kid. Fast forward to college, I was doing jazz stuff in Portland. My jazz band at school, and then they had a Juno 60 in the closet, and the band director asked me if I could help the guy in the other ensemble get an organ sound out of it. And he's like, yeah, take it home. You know, figure it out. You're like, I was like the closest to a keyboard person at the time.
Nice.
And it never came back. It moved to LA with me. Because first time I told him, you can't get an organ sound out of a Juno 60. Not a good one. And from that point on, I just like got obsessed with synths. And that like was a pretty sharp turn from like a future as a jazz pianist in Portland, Oregon, to being obsessed with synths and them being a crucial part of like my employment for the last 15, 13 years in LA. So it was fortuitous. Yeah, moved down to LA, went to MI for a year and got some tours, just like dropped out actually because I got a tour with this guy, Van Hunt, and then got to know Randy Jackson through that because he managed Van Hunt, and then Mariah was looking for a new band and Randy's involved with that. So yeah. Randy put me on that, and then from that point, my, I guess, industry career started.
Yeah, just kept meeting the right people and jumping bands and new gigs.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah, it seems like there's definitely like, it's a big city, but there's like a small pool of people where everybody just kind of knows somebody. It
seems
like anytime I'm down there, that just seems to be the story.
Yeah, most of my work is more or less like, because I knew somebody, you know, there's, I mean, you got to be able to play, but it's a small and big community at the same time, for sure.
Yeah. And even if you couldn't play, you could probably use some kind of MIDI effect in Ableton Live that could help you play.
That's right. Bit. Yeah. Use the chord or the quantizer.
Right. Exactly. Yep. That's true. My music theory is kind of sad, but I find ways to make myself sound like I'm really great at what I do when it comes to playing.
No shame in that. No shame in that.
I'll just stick with drums. Really. It's easier for me. So how did that lead you into learning Ableton Live? Like, how did that kind of come
up? So in Mariah's band, I started out on like aux keys / second keys. And the playback guy, Mike McKnight, who's like been in the playback biz since it was invented. He kind of taught me everything because he had to go do some other work with Roger Waters, the big Pink Floyd tours over the last 10 years. So he taught me to do Mariah's rig, and from then on, I kind of kept developing that skill set. That was in Digital Performer, and I was playing keys and doing playback with Al Black's band, and we do these festivals. This was early on in Al's career, so he had like the 4 p.m. slot or something, and it was always sunny, you know, like, or storming rain, not a long sound check, you know. And I'm trying to do playback. And I see these DJs doing like crazy sets on their baseline MacBook that's like 8 years old, sun's blasting down, and it's fine. Everything's working fine. Whereas like I was running DP and it's sputtering on like the pimped out Mac at the time. I was like, screw this. I'm going to, let me learn Ableton. Let me see what this is about. Also, Al liked to jump around a lot. He didn't want to have a strict linear timeline on the songs because we were way more jammy back then. And so Ableton enabled that because he'd like look back and be like, yeah, I don't want to do the bridge. I'm like, okay. And then, you know, we jump ahead or like we loop a chorus or, I could just drop Ableton out sometimes if stuff got too hairy because we weren't track dependent, but you know, it was augmenting like background vocals, especially.
Right.
The band is not singing. Yeah. Sweetening.
Yeah.
That Ableton kicked off from there. And then after that, I met Daniel Mitzeres, who is in St. Vincent's camp. And this was like a big education for me. I got referred to him because he needed a sub for a period because he was having a kid. And that's a super involved rig. Everything was out of Ableton at the time. He was sending messages to Andy Clark's Kemper to change patches and Eventide to change patches. Mm-hmm. And then Choco the guitarist had a Kemper too and a Minotaur by her that the Ableton rig would like take control of. So sometimes you'd be playing bass, sometimes she'd be playing bass, send patch changes. All the drums were coming out of Ableton from across the stage. And Matt Johnson, amazing drummer, he had like 12 trigger pads. So it was, a bunch of stuff.
A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it's when the iConnect kind of came out, the 4 Plus, so we were using that.
Yeah. I'm actually looking at buying one of the iConnect Audio 4 Pluses right now. I'm actually looking at doing that for myself.
Great. That was like, could not affordable without it. Yeah.
They're not that much.
They're kicking ass right now. So, so Daniel taught me that whole rig and like blew my mind further on the Ableton stuff. And I definitely have him to thank for all of like my Ableton savviness.
Yeah.
I feel like he was doing stuff that it's now common knowledge, but like all the key rack stuff.
Yeah.
He was.
What version would like that have been? When you first got onto it.
Eight or nine.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was eight. Yeah.
That's when I first jumped in, was the early part of eight. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I went to DubSpot in New York City. Are you familiar with that school? They really were pretty instrumental for the YouTube of Ableton Live Ableton tutorials. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that was like, 5 years ago now. So maybe,
Nice.
Oh, and he was also, so the keys rig there, it was just a single 49 note controller. And there was no audio tracks for St. Vincent. It was just MIDI tracks. Mm-hmm. Like, sending out information, but he was able to do the whole set on this 49 key, and it would just dynamically change, you know, as it goes through the songs, like what zones and everything.
Yeah.
And then the buffers at like 128, and everything's running off of that, so it was like sweat dripping.
Yeah, right. Yeah, for people listening right now who maybe aren't really familiar with the whole playback engineering side of things and what we're talking about, the whole Ableton Live playback engineering thing has really become like its own full-time job position for a lot of people on major tours. And a lot of people didn't realize that. I honestly didn't even realize that was like a full-time gig happening frequently for large tours until I met Laura, Laura Escade, which is how we ended up meeting. Took her master track class. That was like, 5 months ago or so, something like that. And there were some great industry experts that have been doing it, like yourself, Peter, and other people came in and basically just sat us down in a chair and talked about like what it looks like to work with an artist on a major tour and taking all their tracks from the studio, setting it up in Ableton Live to perform basically however the artist wants. And for somebody like Kanye, it can change every show. So it's like learning tons of workflows and tips and tricks to quickly set up tracks and be able to do redundancy, which I think is a big staple for Laura in the way that she does it in her process, which is really great.
A lot of the bands I was in, I was doing keys and playback. Like playback engineers are getting way more common now. Mm-hmm. It used to be like a secret, you know, because back earlier days you didn't want people to know you're using tracks, but nowadays it's like, yeah, we're using tracks.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah, exactly. So. And even auto-tune. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, would you say that most vocalists or a lot of vocalists are using it in some capacity, like that you worked with at least?
I don't know if most. Laura's done way more of that than me, like especially in like hip-hop genre stuff. But like indie bands aren't doing auto-tune long.
Right. And pop, I guess, more so, would you say?
Yeah, pop and like urban music, yeah.
Yeah. Do you, when you have used,
which is cool because you couldn't do that like 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
Sure.
Or at least easily.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. I love the new Auto-Tune Advanced that came out not terribly long ago. I've used that for a couple people that I've done some playback with, and I think so. Universal Audio came out with their own version of it too recently, not that long ago.
Okay, with the Antares stuff.
Yeah. And honestly, I haven't messed with Antares that much. I've been using the UAD version for last year and a half or so. But it's great because if you use the IAC driver, you can automate it in the console before it hits Ableton Live, and that's less strain on the DAW. Yeah, that's always fun. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, for people who maybe are, this is kind of new to them, say I was an artist and I came to you and I had, say, like a large tour and was like, I want you to take these tracks, maybe I've got 16 stems for each song or whatever, and I want you to import it into Ableton Live. And I like, how would you go about that process with that artist? Like, what does that typically look like?
It totally depends on the artist. You know, some don't really know what that all entails. Some are like really involved, like the St. Vincent, she was knows all of that stuff, so she was all about getting it perfect. But it's, you know, ideally with a live situation, you figure out what do they want for the show to make it different than the record. Some mm-hmm. people just want the record, but like, what are you going to do in your live show that augments this? So, and then what do we need from playback that's like necessary to have for to merge the two? You know, and that sometimes that's like loops or percussion things, effects-y things, synthy things. If there's, you know, like 10 other tracks and you only have one keyboardist on tour, you know,
yeah. So,
figuring out how to hybridize the band situation as opposed to having it 100% one way or 100% the other way. You know, how are we going to make these exist together?
Sure.
The playback guy, that's his job to streamline that, you know.
Yeah.
The production or creative or artist is the one who gets to just share the concepts.
Right. So it's really the playback engineer's job just to make those concepts become a reality.
Yeah.
And how it's all performed live.
Yeah.
So on a tour like that, I mean, you have the playback engineer, but there's also usually an MD or a musical director, and you've had some experience doing that as well, right?
Yeah.
So talk about that role. Like, if somebody doesn't really know what a musical director does, like, what does that person do?
It's like a band leader at its most basic, but they're the kind of the head that the artist can talk to about band issues or creative issues. It really depends on the artist what that all entails. Like with Aloe, he doesn't want to worry about the band situation, so we would just kind of lead everything. And then other artists, like with Adam Lambert, he's very involved, and we would be talking about set stuff and track levels and like EQ things and stuff each show.
Yeah. Do you find that refreshing for an artist who's technical, so you can really get what he wants?
My favorite balance is when they understand it, but they also appreciate how, like, what it takes to do. Because if it's just like a kid in a candy store and they think they can ask for all these things, and, you know, at some point, like, you run out of time or it's going to cause problems for the show. My best experiences have been when they know what's possible and they're excited about it, but, you know, understand, like, what it takes.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite artists that you've worked with?
I really liked working with Adam Lambert. I was not familiar with his music at all before working with him. And then just the more we worked, he was just like super respectful and involved. And it was a big challenge. He's very specific about some things musically. I learned a lot through that year and a half. So he was a lot of fun. Subbing for Daniel in St. Vincent was probably my favorite, that one.
Yeah.
Tons of fun, because it was, like, musically challenging, intellectually, like, every night, you know, you're just like, oh, man, that was great. I kicked my ass, but that was fun. Whereas other gigs, like, kick your ass, and you're like, oh, gosh, I don't know if I can do that again.
Yeah.
But every gig I've done, you learn something new, you get some new experience, so the next time it's easier, or you're able to handle it with more grace, or the things that I went through in the Mariah band over 7 years were so educational, I think crucial to me learning how to handle so many different situations that don't come up in music school, you know, or with like a smaller band, ridiculous situations.
Right.
I mean, I'll look back and be like, wow, that's crazy, but we made it.
Right. Still have a job.
Here would be an MD playback thingy. Like, we were in Morocco, and it was for a TV. They were taping this concert, huge concert, and it was going to go out live. And they wanted to have, like, a Moroccan drum ensemble, like, play the intro of the show. Cool. And we had, you know, like, you rehearse in back in L.A., and everything's set up, and there's lights, and it's very specific. It's not like an improv band. Like, it's got a very specific flow to it. But that's, you know, the production wanted, like, hey, let's get this involved. And we've got 3 hours until, you know, airtime, so let's figure it out. So the Moroccan band shows up, and they're incredible. Like, I wish I just had loops and loops and loops of all their stuff. It has so
you're
much
sitting
vibe.
There just hitting record and able to have, like, it's gonna be a great sample pack later.
But, you know, like, their time is not on a click. It goes up and down all over the place. And there, so first we tried to, like, record it with a set of mics because we were going to pre-record it and line it up with the show, and that did not work because, you know, I'm coming to them and like trying to screw up their game.
Yeah, right.
What's a click?
What like, who's think? This guy?
So we recorded them at soundcheck, and like the drummer was trying to direct them to like be in some sort of BPM time.
Yeah.
Took those stems, ran back to the hotel, and like edited like a madman and stretched and pulled and a
lot of warping.
Yeah, a lot of warping. But got that together and threw it into the show so that when we did the show, they were playing live, but they were more or less miming to themselves.
Okay. That's
the only way that would have worked.
So they were playing on top of basically what they already, yeah. I gotcha. That could sound crazy if the monitoring wasn't set right for them.
Yeah, but you know, the TV feed was tracks of them from a couple hours prior.
Gotcha. So,
quote unquote fixed, you know?
Yeah. Like,
but that's
drum mimes.
Yeah, that was just like a crazy situation to walk into, but we made it work, you know.
Yeah.
There was another one with Aloe where we showed up and they wanted like the Glee Choir of Texas University or something, and creative was like, yeah, we want to have this as the opener of the show because we were playing at that university or whatever, and it was also a TV thing, and so we creative is just like, make this happen. And I'm like, okay, well now let's figure this out. So we were going to do a pre-record and so we set up two mics. They're singing to click in silence, you know, and they're not good. Like the tune is disastrous.
A lot of auto-tune.
Yeah. So, recorded them and stretched and fixed and layered over some samples. And then same thing, you know, it all had to happen really fast.
Yeah.
But if you don't know your DAW, you know, if you don't know how to handle that, that could be like a disaster, a time-wasting, money-wasting disaster. But
totally.
Hey, here's the situation. Make it work. Boom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Hey guys, this is the part where I interrupt the podcast to remind you, if you haven't checked out Pigments yet, Arteria's new plugin, at some point, either now or later, go click on that link in the show notes, get the free download of Pigments, play with it. It's about $200, so definitely worth it to add to your arsenal and have a huge library of creativity with a really cool synth that can do a lot of things. Check that out, link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and let's get back to it. That's kind of like in the master track class with Laura, that was a lot of the training we had. It's like, how fast can you work? How quick can you think? Mm-hmm. And not even just on a technical editing level and live, but like an interpersonal level. Like the last day we had some band come in and they had them bark orders at us, and we had to be able to like deal with the stressful situation of dealing with an artist. I mean, it was all like a play scenario, but like the artist was like kind of a diva and like that's asking good. All these
perfect example
that's yeah good. Exactly, and you just gotta be like, oh yeah, everything's great, this, you know, this is awesome.
Well, because you can have all the technical stuff, but unless you know how to apply
people.
I mean, it's like recording with an artist or recording
right.
And like
totally,
so what if you know the technical manuals for your console or whatever? I mean, know that, but then you really are dealing with people in that situation,
and right,
if you flub that, then doesn't matter if you know that the input impedance with the, you know, and my CCs are flying all over here, and
it doesn't matter.
You're like, you're in the business of people, so if you don't know how to work with them, it doesn't matter.
And that's very well said. That is true. It is the business of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of industries are like that, but especially with music. And even not even just in a playback scenario, but like I do a lot of like mixing and mastering for some other artists. And, you know, when I have the final result and I show it to them, if they listen to it over and over and over and over and over, then like a lot of times they hear it so much that they just like make up things in their head that need to be fixed. And you just kind of have to kind of roll with it and manage the expectation of like, yeah, I think that snare sounds really great. Like, try to get them not to listen to it for the 20th time. Like, and move
that's
on.
That's people management. That's not.
Totally.
Or the other classic is, you know, they made a demo in GarageBand or something. They come to you, produce it, and they're so attached to like the snare that was, you know, that they pulled up because they've listened to it 1,000 times. So if you did anything different, it's like, whoa. But
exactly. Yeah, that's why I don't even master my own projects that I produce from the ground up because of that. Because it's like
smart. Yeah.
You hear it over and over and over, and you just want to jump off a cliff after, you know, mastering it at the very end of the day.
Yeah,
which isn't good for anybody. Like, as far as using live, do you are you in live 24/7? Is like, is
yeah,
that your
AFDAR,
or do you use anything else?
I sometimes go to Logic because that's my other. Sometimes for like orchestral stuff, because having the key switches not be lined up and quantized, you know, like, or sometimes even with those libraries, like the sample is actually late, so everything kind of has to, since it's less grid based, Logic sometimes helps me there, but otherwise I'm in Ableton.
Yeah, me too.
The thing I've been running into lately is I've been doing more like film, TV, media scoring stuff, and you know, Ableton has a blind spot for time code and video a bit.
Do you import like the actual edited video into Live and then just score around it?
Is that yeah, when I'm doing something where I feel like Live is important to use, like usually if it's more electronic based, you know, Live is like my comfort zone. So I'll put the video in Live, score to that, and then sometimes move it to Logic or Pro Tools to do the other bit.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I've done a little bit of that, but I've always been fascinated with getting more into editing and scoring for film. I feel like from a producer standpoint, there could be good money in that, a little more so than working with the indie band scene, you know?
Yeah,
at least totally. You work with the right film or TV.
I mean, there's just like any of the other avenues of music, there's a lot of guys working in there now, but I've enjoyed it. And like some people like working with artists more than I do. Like they have the, like I said, the people bit, you know?
Yeah.
It's like scoring. You're still working with directors and producers, but it's not somebody's.
I'm not breathing down your neck as much, like in the studio.
They might be, but it's just different. I feel like it's a little different.
Yeah.
Or if it's like some of the ad stuff I've done, it's definitely not like this is their song baby that they've worked on for 10 years. No, you know,
they just want a good jingle.
Yeah, and they know what works and what doesn't. So,
totally.
In fact, some of my pals from Passion Fit, Xander Singh and
Twist. Yeah, I've met those guys.
They're great guys. So they
are.
You know,
they're fun.
Their faces are Passion Fit. Ian was a founding member, and they both now do scoring full time, like big stuff for Netflix and Apple TV. And Ian's had some features. They were like, screw scoring. I'm doing scoring.
I feel like it's a fun, creative field because you're not just like tied into one genre. You have to like get creative and really create the sound that fits whatever the visual is, which could be all kinds of different things. So it's like kind of fun.
I've enjoyed my little taste of it.
I had, for example, my first real take of doing something like that was actually pretty recent, and it was for this place called Ezra's Enlightened Cafe. It's like this Buddhist like vegan restaurant. So like I've never had experience scoring like Middle Eastern stuff, and like I found some crazy didgeridoo sounds and like chopped them up, and that's like the sound design part that's like super fun and nerdy for me.
Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you wouldn't necessarily get to do that on like a project or something.
Totally not. Totally not. So what are some of the most, I guess, like common technical issues that you've run into going back a little bit to like playback engineering, like on a tour or like setup?
I guess the stuff that just is all the time is like either changing keys, changing tempos, or doing transitions for artists. And you can have all your Ableton stuff all nice and neat, but as soon as you get into the rehearsal room and start editing, like it's a disaster by the end of the night if you're not careful. So, I've gotten in the habit of I'll just like duplicate the whole song on the timeline. This is all in arrangement to you. Just duplicate it and go edit that second version, but you still have your first version available because the artist might be like, oh, everything I just said for the last 3 hours, forget that. No, I want to go back to the other one. And you're like,
That's a lot of Command Z at that point.
Yeah, it's a lot of Command Z. Yeah. So, you know, it's still there, unaffected.
Yeah.
You know, don't touch your channel strip volume settings. Like, you know, leave yourself some safe spaces to revert to.
Totally.
So that's a common one. Or like when you're stitching two songs together because they want to transition. You know, maybe later they decide they don't want those songs playing one into the other. They want them separate. And if you've stitched the only versions in your timeline, then you know, jumping back to another one's going to be problematic. So just duplicate it. Go work on it. You know. further down the timeline.
Right.
That's like the easiest safety tip.
So you're pretty much most of the time in arrangement view then?
When I do arrangement view because, like, especially in rehearsals, and especially if time is an issue where you don't have tons and tons of days with the band, you got 3 days to throw a 70-minute tour set together. You got to be quick. So it's like, well, we just want to work on the bridge. You got to start from the bridge. You can't, if you're in session view, you know, that gets problematic.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I'm going to start you guys two bars before the second verse. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, go. You know, an arrangement view allows you all that flexibility more so than session view. So session view is, I feel like in my situations, once stuff's dialed in and it's dummy proof, and if it's a band where things aren't going to change, which sometimes is the case, then session view is great because
it
takes out potential for so many other things. But that's
trade-off. Just launch that scene and just away you go.
Launch that scene, and if the drummer's launching playback because they're a smaller budget, then make it as easy and streamlined as possible.
So, right. Yeah, and the consolidate time to new scene is a really great feature too for that kind of thing. For anybody listening, you just highlight the however much time you want, right click, consolidate time to new scene. It'll take everything and all the automation and arrangement and just throw it into a scene in session view, which is always nice. So, pro tip for the day for all the listeners.
I'll take that one. That's nice.
Yeah. Thomas Falds actually shared that with me. So you can do all, and that's what I used to do actually before I was always doing session view until, which you know about like Setlist Pro. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Yeah. Which by Strange Electronics. Yeah. You can just rename the locator and arrangement view for anybody listening. And then you can have like this, it's a Max for Live device, and you just can launch individual locators and MIDI map them and get pretty creative with that. So do you use that for when you do playback?
I haven't been using it just because it's more recent and I haven't been doing as much like playback stuff lately. But I'm sure I would have used it. Like my Adam Lambert rig, I was doing keys, band leader and playback. So I had 3 laptops on stage, 2 redundant playback ones, and then a soft synth rig. Cause it was also like 100% soft synth because it was all EDM-y stuff.
Yeah.
And so I was using an iConnect with TouchOSC on my iPad to jump around stuff. Setlist would have made that a lot easier. So.
Yeah, TouchOSC, that's been around for a little while, though, hasn't it? Yeah, that's like a hidden gem I feel like a lot of people don't even know about. If I had an iPad, I probably would have used that before.
Well, and I've been on like smaller band things where I'll just use my iPhone. You know, if it's like a 5 song set with an indie band,
nice.
You don't want to be face down in a laptop, you can set my iPhone on the Nord and just be like,
make sure your phone's charged.
Make sure your phone's charged.
That'd be a bummer.
I don't want an iMessage popping up when you're supposed to trigger.
Yeah, right. Bing! Just plays through the speakers. That'd be a bummer. Yeah. Well, so what advice would you give to somebody maybe who's wanting to do what you do, say like, as either a playback engineer or just like playing on a tour, doing this kind of technical setup for artists, like how would somebody even go about getting started with something like that?
Right. Well, I've had a long journey, but
you've been doing it for a while, obviously, but
I think the most crucial points, for me was like the synth obsession. I dove headfirst into it and I really knew it. Remember I was trying to be like more keyboardist for every genre out of school. Like, oh, I can do that. I can do that. And I had a buddy who told me, like, no, be that guy, or be this guy, like, be the synth guy, or if you find a niche that you're able to explore more, then I think you can get more out of that. Because we're not going to be masters of everything, jack of all trades, master of none. So if you choose some lanes to specialize in, then I think you'll start getting more work. Other side of that, keep learning all the other stuff too.
Yeah.
Like if I had never learned playback stuff, or if I had not jumped into Ableton, after, like I said earlier, seeing folks using it at festivals, like, the last 4 years of employment, all of that was so crucial to the work I've had the last 2 years, which me, coming as a keyboardist and being like, I'm going to learn this other skill to add to my collection. You know, yeah. I'm still excelling in my niche, but I'm adding another niche.
So. Sure. Like necessary skills to build off of the foundation that you already have in your niche. Yeah.
Stay hungry, you know, keep learning. And like, especially with Ableton, there's 100 different ways of doing things. So I, you know, right. I'll hear people talk about it and how they're doing stuff and take what I can from that and, you know, maybe inject it into what I'm doing.
Yeah, totally. That's cool, man. Like I like your website. I'm actually looking at it right now for the third time and it's very clean. I need to update mine. But for anybody who's wanting to, I guess, stay connected with you and like future happenings of what you're doing, where would you tell them to
go? Can you mail me through the website, peterdyer.net, or follow me on Instagram, peterkeys88. Just hit me up.
And yeah.
I had a guy hit me up about a patch I used on a demo, and he was just asking what the settings were. Yeah, you know, like if I got time, absolutely. Happy to help.
Yes.
Spread the synth knowledge.
Yes, do it. You're making the world a better place.
No harm in asking.
Right. Yeah, man, honestly, I could always use more patches, like for all of my synths and my Sub 37 too as well.
Bunch of presets for the Sub 37 of mine on the Moog site, so you can download.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'll definitely go check that out for sure.
They're on the wackier side because they wanted me to focus on the looping envelopes at the time, but okay. Yeah, there's like 50 presets of kind of out there stuff, so
I'm all into. I like the weird stuff. Yeah, so
that's good. At the Moog site. So.
Cool. Yeah, man. Well, everybody, if you're listening right now, check out the show notes and we'll have links to like your Instagram and your website, peterdyer.net. That's D-Y-E-R, in case you're wondering. And yeah, dude, thank you. I'll respect your time. I know you've got other stuff to do today and like, this has been fun. Like I could sit here and nerd out with you for another like 12 and a half hours. but yeah, man, this is cool. Thank you for joining the podcast.
Definitely
be in touch. I'm going to go check out those presets on the Moog site and download those and play with those later tonight. Get weird with it. It'll be fun. Cool, man. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for joining the podcast. And yeah, maybe we'll have you back at another time, sometime down the road.
Thanks, Dan.
Sweet. Yeah, man. Take it easy.
This podcast is sponsored by liveproducersonline.com, a community of Ableton Live users connecting you to the pros to learn today's music production.